Hello, you. This is the antibiotic resistant podcast special issue of Inside Science from BBC Radio 4, first broadcast on the 9th of June 2016, and I'm Adam Rutherford. TV and film references on this programme include Jerry Maguire, Field of Dreams and Doctor Who. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. Today we're dedicating the whole programme to one of the biggest threats that we humans face, and it's a problem of our own creation. Alexander Fleming first spotted what became penicillin in 1928, and in doing so, he revolutionised medicine. Innumerable lives have been literally saved by stopping bacterial infection. But there has been massive overuse in agriculture. In medicine, we've been using a small number of antibiotics repeatedly, and this has resulted in bacteria developing resistance to every single one. For a few years, we've been hearing about MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, so-called superbugs in hospitals. Handwashing practices have changed as a result, and that has made a difference. But the global situation is not getting much better. On the 26th of May this year, reports started coming in of the detection of bacteria that are resistant to all antibiotics currently used in medicine, as reported here on PBS News.
For the first time in the U.S., a person has been found to be carrying a strain of E. coli that's resistant to antibiotics of last resort. The Washington Post reported the strain was discovered last month in a 49-year-old Pennsylvania woman. She was resistant to colistin, and researchers said it, quote, heralds the emergence of a truly pan-drug-resistant bacteria.
Around the same time in May over here, a major report was released that has attempted to document the scale of this problem. Now, I'm not prone to scaremongering, but this is pretty chilling.
Develop new drugs for the future to tackle superbugs, says a report, or risk one death every 3 seconds.
We are facing a calamity and we need to act together as a world if calamity is to be avoided. That is the message today from Lord O'Neill, Jim O'Neill, the economist and chairman of the government's review on antimicrobial resistance.
The whole series of recommendations we're making are sort of split into things to boost the supply of new drugs and interventions to reduce the demand, excessive demand for drugs. Right in the centre of it is a bigger role for so-called rapid diagnostics. We live in an age where mobile technology dominates our lives, and yet in this space we still behave as we did 1950s, if not earlier.
That was Jim O'Neill. Now, we're already at 700,000 preventable deaths per year as a result of antibiotic resistance, and the O'Neill report suggests that this will rise to 10 million people per year by 2050. And by then, the global cost of failing to produce new antibiotics will be, brace yourselves, $100 trillion. Now, that is an unimaginably large amount of money, but it breaks down in cost of treatment, hospital hours, to about $10,400 for every man, woman and child alive in 2050. Now, Radio 4 listeners might have heard all about the history of antibiotics on In Our Time this morning, or immediately after this show if you're listening to the Thursday evening repeat. And of course, it's all available on the podcast. Here on Inside Science, we're picking up the story on where we are today and focusing on the attempts to discover new classes of antibiotics and alternative therapies for combating bacterial infection. But to start off, we have to talk about money. Developing drugs is an expensive business. They have to be invented or discovered, and they have to be rigorously tested for safety and for efficacy in several rounds of clinical trials before doctors can prescribe them. That process takes time and money, which has been the main barrier to the discovery of novel treatments in the last few decades. I spoke to Dr. Jack Scannell, who is an expert on the economics of drug development and contributed to the O'Neill report. I asked him why we haven't discovered any new antibiotics for so long, and he took us back to the very beginning.
First, there was a really effective way of discovering antibiotics that worked very well, I'd say, between roughly 1945 and 1960. But by the 1980s, it had really died out. And that was based on finding bugs, usually in soil, usually from one particular class of bug, growing them in a vat, and finding chemicals that they spat out that killed other bugs. And the vast majority of the antibiotics that we now use were discovered in that way. And by 1980, we thought we had lots of great antibiotics and we didn't realise we had a problem. And then you combine that with the fact that a lot of the early antibiotics were brought to market with the rather relaxed, benign, some would say reckless regulatory environment that you had in the 1950s and 60s. By the 1990s and 2000s, any new antibiotics had to go through much, much tougher regulatory processes. And then you compound that with the fact that it just wasn't a particularly lucrative drug class. unlike some other therapy areas, for various complicated reasons, the industry didn't have much pricing power.
But what about in the 1990s when we began to sequence genomes by the bucket load? That must have been a fruitful time.
Well, I think there was huge optimism at the time. Bacteria have got small genomes. They were some of the first organisms to be fully sequenced. And several of the large drug companies made very major efforts to sequence bacterial genomes. You look for genes that are common across a bunch of important pathogenic bacteria. And then you look for genes where there isn't a close homologue in man. And the idea is that those genes will be great targets, because if you can block them or block their products, you kill lots of different sorts of bug, but you don't kill people. But in fact, it proved surprisingly unproductive.
This probably shows my naivety about economics more than anything else. But if we're so desperate to find new antibiotics, and it is such a global crisis, as the O'Neill report points out very explicitly, I would have thought that there's an enormous financial incentive for big pharmaceutical companies to come up with novel antibiotics that they can sell to the global market.
Well, the way a lot of drug markets work is I think, more to do with historical accident than design. And antibiotics are peculiarly non-lucrative.
And what sort of numbers are we talking about in terms of developing a new class, if that was something that one of the big pharma companies was going to do?
The straight answer there is no one knows. Developing new drugs, I think, the best way of thinking about the economics of drug R&D is like thinking about a lottery. So if you ask someone the question, how much does it cost to win the lottery? Right. Well, some lucky people win £1 million by buying a £1 ticket. But on average, it costs more than £1 to win £1 on the lottery. Drug R&D has similar characteristics. So if you think about drugs going into clinical development, only 1 in 10 drugs on average going into clinical development emerges. And at the start of the process, no one really knows which one of those is going to be. So it's easy to calculate averages, but averages are not terribly meaningful. You know, $1 billion is probably not a bad place to start. The successful drugs will have had far less than $1 billion spent on them. But there'll be lots of unsuccessful drugs that never come to market that cost a lot of money.
So if it costs, you know, something in the order of $1 billion to develop a drug, and we know that the problem of antimicrobial resistance is global, it's going to affect everyone on Earth, who is going to stump up the cash? Who is going to have the guts to commit to this R&D for the benefit of the whole planet?
My sense is there's a relatively small number of countries with relatively large health budgets and relatively strong pharmaceutical industries. Any one of them could probably, if it was sufficiently motivated, deliver a substantial component of the market stimulus required to get antimicrobial discovery underway. It may not be particularly palatable for finance ministers, but the sums involved are not huge. So the O'Neill Review, for example, talks about support in the order of $18 billion over 10 years. Well, that's probably about a third of the cost of HS2, and it's probably something like 3 to 4 Royal Navy aircraft carriers. So the sums here are large, but they're not enormous, particularly given the severity of the potential long-term problem.
A lot of the research that we talk about on this programme tends to be focused on the academic and universities. But if the development of new antibiotics is going to come from big pharma, then what is the tenor of the conversations that they are having? What are they thinking about what they should do or could do or whether they will do anything at all?
So most biopharmaceutical research is paid for by industry, not for by governments. It's done industrially and not in academic laboratories. That's an important point to bear in mind. So it's very important to get the industry involved. Regarding the mood, I would say there's probably two broad camps in the sort of commercial biopharmaceutical world. I think there is one camp that I would probably guess is a large minority, whose view is, if we build it, they will come. Right. So there are already quite a lot of people spending money on antibiotic R&D. They're probably not doing as much as we want, and they're probably not doing some of the risky stuff for novel mechanisms and novel drug targets that we might like. But there are a bunch of people spending money already. I think there's then another slightly larger contingent whose, I think, view is, when we see the money, we're going to do something. There's a classic scene in the film Jerry Maguire where Cuba Gooding Jr. Gets on the phone to Jerry Maguire and screams down the phone, "Show me the money, show me the money." And one thing I suggest is that whenever the O'Neill Review team or anyone advocating funding for AMR goes to a meeting at the G20 or at the UN, they should have behind them playing as a constant loop, "Show me the money." That's what the sticking point is now. It's not that we haven't had enough health economic analysis. It's the fact that skeptics are not convinced real money will be forthcoming soon enough and in concrete enough terms.
Show me the money. Jack Scannell on the economics of antibiotic development. Now, most of the antibiotics we use in the clinic were discovered in the mid-20th century. But as the threat of drug-resistant infections increases, the race is on to find new microbes that make new drugs. We've only identified a tiny fraction of the microbes living on Earth and are looking for new, useful ones in wildly different locations. This is known as bioprospecting. Some of the places and creatures that might make good quarries are rather exotic. Microbiologist Matt Hutchings has been looking to the oldest farmers in the world, leafcutter ants. Matt told me how ants culture antibiotics.
So firstly, they grow their own food. So a lot of people think that they eat leaves, but in fact, they go out to the rainforest canopy, they cut the leaves, they bring them back to their nest, and they feed them to a fungus, and then they eat the fungus. The problem they have is they create this warm, humid underground nest where the fungus grows, and lots of other fungi and bacteria want to get in on the act. So their fungus is very susceptible to disease. So what they've done is evolved another symbiosis with antibiotic-producing bacteria that they grow on their bodies, and the ants literally use them as weed killers.
It's just astonishing that that process has evolved.
It's incredible, yeah. So it's evolved over the last, the best guess is between 50 and 60 million years ago, this evolved. So they've been using antibiotics and growing their own food for much, much longer than humans.
And it's effectively exactly the same as farming. We grow things and we don't want to grow weeds. So we use chemicals to stop them from growing, which is pretty much the same system, isn't it?
That's right. I think it's the oldest example of agriculture in nature.
Just amazing, amazing creatures. Now, how does that inform this conversation that we're having at the moment about antibiotic resistance and development of new antibiotics?
Well, one of the interesting things about the ant system, or the leafcutter ant system, is that they never get drug resistance in their nests, so they have no problems with drug-resistant infections. So we think they're using antibiotics more cleverly than we are.
That's quite a damning indictment of human behaviour, but how are they more clever than us at deploying antibiotics?
Well, I mean, we've been using antibiotics for less than 100 years, and pretty much every infectious strain of bacteria or fungi now is resistant to at least one antibiotic. These ants have co-evolved parasites, so things that specifically have adapted to infect their fungus gardens, and yet none of them are resistant to the antibiotics. And we think what the ants do is they recruit different types of antibiotic-producing bacteria, and they use cocktails of antibiotics. And in that way, this kind of multi-drug therapy prevents drug resistance arising.
Whereas historically, over the last few decades, we've just been throwing antibiotics at everything willy-nilly,
yeah,
which gives an opportunity for the bacteria to develop resistance.
Yeah, I mean, the planet is awash with antibiotics anyway. But typically, when you go to the doctor and you're ill, you usually get one antibiotic. And it's quite easy for a bacterial strain that's inside your body to become resistant to that antibiotic if there's only one. If you challenge it with more than one, then it's hard to become resistant to multiple antibiotics at the same time.
So there is a great deal to be learnt from leafcutter ants about how we develop and deploy antibiotics.
Yeah, we think so. We think it's a fascinating system.
And what about actually isolating new ones? So if we could use some of the antibiotics that the leafcutter ants have developed, mm-hmm, is it possible to synthesise them or grow them or what?
Yeah, so what we do, we go out. So actually a PhD student and a postdoc in my lab came back from Panama yesterday with new colonies of leafcutter ants. And what we do is we isolate the bacteria from the ants and then we grow them in culture, so on petri dishes. And what we've started to do recently is sequence the genome, so sequence all of their DNA, and then we can predict what kind of antibiotics they might make. And then we can use that to guide the purification of those antibiotics and solve their structures. And what we find is that this niche is enriched, so it's a very rich source of novel chemistry, so novel antibiotics that we don't see or we haven't seen before.
And how similar or different are they to the ones that we deploy in the GP surgery as standard?
I mean, some of them are completely different. So new, what we call a new chemical scaffold. So the chemical structure is not like anything we've seen before.
And does that mean they have great value to us? I mean, will they be useful ultimately, or versions, will they be useful to us in treating diseases?
I mean, it certainly means that there'll be no evolved resistance in infectious microbes to these chemical structures, because the things that infect us won't have seen these antibiotics before. But of course, you know, we need to discover, our aim is to discover hundreds or even thousands of new natural products, and a small fraction of those will be safe for use in humans.
What sort of timescale? I know scientists hate being asked that question, but I'm required to ask it. But what sort of timescale do we think we might see the deployment of these sorts of antibiotics for people?
Well, it sounds like a terribly long time, but probably 15 or 20 years to them actually being deployed in the clinic.
That doesn't sound like that. long to me. I mean, I know we're facing a global crisis at the moment. The news is not good, but 10 to 15 years for the development of a drug isn't that bad, really, is it?
I don't think so. And the O'Neill report that came out in May said that what we really need to do is stimulate early stage discovery. They predict, so economists love to model everything, and they predict that by 2050, 10 million people will die from drug-resistant infections around the world, which is more people than die of cancer at the moment. So what they suggest is that governments fund early-stage discovery, the kind of stuff that we do and lots of other people are trying to do, to find new natural product antibiotics from bacteria and fungi so they can go into the clinical trials pipeline, because it takes 15 to 20 years before they get to the clinic.
So you're working with the leafcutters up in Norwich, but what other species should we be looking at? What other species are people looking at? Is it that we've just been looking at the obvious ones? Is it that we just haven't been creative enough, or we haven't explored the natural world enough, and that's got us into this fix in the first place?
I think so. I mean, historically what happened was, so Fleming discovered penicillin, and then soil microbiologists like Selman Waksman started to look at soil microbes. And the soil was a great source of new antibiotics. So in the 1940s and 1950s, what we call the golden age of antibiotic discovery, they discovered hundreds of new compounds. But of course, the more you look in the same place, the more you look in the soil, the more you start to rediscover the same stuff over and over again. And really, drug companies lost interest because of the rediscovery problem. They started to spend a lot of money and time, and all they do was discover the same strains of bacteria making the same antibiotics. But crucially, they only ever looked in soil. So now what we're trying to do is look in different places, like the deep sea, leafcutter ant nests, places where bacteria have co-evolved with other animals. And when we do that, we find new antibiotics.
Matt Hutchings at UEA. So, while we're looking to all these exotic places and species for new antibiotics, bear in mind that antibiotics were discovered by Alexander Fleming just a couple of miles from here in not very exotic London. And so a team at University College London has been following his lead and looking closer to home for new antibiotics. Dr. Adam Roberts runs a scheme called Swab and Send. It's a citizen science project that asks members of the public to swab a surface in or around their homes and send it to him so he can look for the presence of new antibiotic-producing bacteria. And volunteers have been swabbing a huge range of places, banknotes, ticket machines at train stations, a cat's nose, and quite a collection from men's beards. The project is still in its early stages, but Adam hopes that the next antibiotic could be found right under our noses. Now, what is under my nose at this precise moment is this microphone. So, Adam sent me one of his kits, and a couple of days ago, I swabbed this microphone, as well as a few other places at the BBC. I've snuck into the Today programme studios and I'm just going to swab some of the presenters' mics. So this one is Nick Robinson's and this one is Sarah Montague's. And all the rest of them as well. This is the second floor tea station, and this sponge looks slightly revolting, so let's swab that here. Now, this is the doormat of the revolving doors at the front of New Broadcasting House, which are really difficult to hoover, so I'm just going to nip in and get a swab from here. And while we're in the foyer of the BBC, there's this very special guest who stands guard over the media cafe. It is a gold Dalek. And there's a security guard standing right behind me, but I'm just going to ignore him for a second while I quickly swab the Dalek. So we sent the swabs off and now have come to University College London to the lab of Dr. Adam Roberts to see what they found.
My name's Adam Roberts. I'm a senior lecturer here at UCL. Me and my team investigate how bacteria become resistant to antibiotics and also try and find new ones.
OK, so we sent you the swabs from the BBC. Before we get to the results, are they sort of typical places? Obviously, Jenny Murray's microphone is not typical. It's very special. But are they typical in terms of what we might find?
They're typical in terms of what people have swabbed, because they usually swab their immediate surroundings. The Dalek's quite an odd one. We have not had any Daleks before.
Okay, so that was the selection.
Yep.
I can see you've got the plates in front of us. What were the results like?
Okay, so first of all, we've got an agar plate here, with all of the different bacteria gridded out.
Oh, yeah.
So the first five along this column are from the Today programme microphones.
Hold on a sec. So we've got a sort of grid of dots with little colonies of bacteria. And so column one is the Today programme mics. That's what you're saying?
Yep.
And then
the second swab that you did.
That's mine and Jenny Murray's microphone. Yes.
And then we've got this one, that one, and that one. They are from the T-Station sponge.
Okay.
Okay, then we've got the Dalek, and we've got 12 different bacteria.
Yeah, I see. That's interesting. So a more diverse range of bacteria from the Dalek.
Yeah.
Which I suppose makes sense, because loads of people come in and they want to touch the Dalek.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not a surprise.
And these colonies look different from each other. Does that mean that they are different species?
Yes. Different genera. They could be different species, but we would think that they're different genera by their appearance.
Okay, and the final column?
They are all from the carpet inside the revolving door, so that welcome mat.
Okay, so that's growing them out in the first place, successful swabbing there.
And then we've repeated that on an agar plate, which has been pre-inoculated with the indicator strain. So you can see on the background of the plate, there's all that bacterial growth.
So the second plate, there's loads of bacteria on it, and if you put the new ones on and they're producing an antibiotic, it kills or it prevents the growth of the indicator strain.
Exactly, yeah. And we'll get a usual circular zone of clearing.
Which is effectively what Fleming did in discovering penicillin.
Absolutely.
All those years
identical.
Ago. So what you can see here is that there are some clear spots around, well, at least four of the colonies, which means that they are producing an antibiotic.
Yep, so those four are producing something, probably an antibiotic, which is killing or inhibiting the indicator strain.
So identify them for us again.
Dalek.
That's the Dalek, yes.
And then the third one is a Dalek, fourth one Dalek, fifth one Dalek.
So they're all from the Dalek?
So they're all from the Dalek. So we've got at least three different types of bacteria from the Dalek, which we're able to exterminate our Micrococcus indicator strain.
Oh, it was all too obvious, but well done for getting that in. I feel like I ought to point out, for health and safety reasons, that there is a large sign next to the Dalek which says, please do not touch the Dalek. Your results seem to indicate that they have not adhered to that.
Yes, it would be highly unlikely that nobody has ever touched that Dalek.
Anyway, what then happens? So you found something interesting across the BBC only on the Dalek, but what's the next stage?
So what we would do, what we have done with the thousands of other bacteria we've analysed, is to analyse them against some alternative indicator strains as well. This indicator strain is a Micrococcus, and it's quite a weedy bacteria, and lots of things can stop it growing. We've got some other more hardy bacterial indicators, such as E. coli, which was isolated from a urinary tract infection in Egypt a few years ago. And this particular bacteria is resistant to about 14 or 15 different antibiotics already. So that's exactly the type of bacteria we want to be able to kill with new antibiotics. So we would screen these against that as well. If they kill that one, we would then probably take it a little bit further in our research and try and identify the molecules responsible for the zones of inhibition that you can see on the plates.
Okay, and so that is the technique to prevent you from accidentally rediscovering penicillin or any of the existing antibiotics.
Yeah, it's really easy to rediscover known antibiotics.
So from the Swab and Send programme, have you actually found anything which is of scientific interest?
Yes, we have. We've found lots that can kill our indicator strains. And what we've actually done is narrowed it down to 20 bacteria that we've found from the swabs, which can now kill the multi-drug resistant E. coli and either MRSA and Candida albicans.
That's fantastic work, and that's really exciting, but it does make me think that we just haven't been looking. If you're finding these bugs so easily, we can't have been looking very hard.
That's absolutely correct. For years, decades now, we haven't looked. The companies with the capability to do these large screens, they withdrew from the market and concentrated on other things.
And if this makes it into a research paper and is published, you're going to have to credit Davros.
Indeed, yes. It'll be the first intergalactic accreditation on a scientific paper.
Antimicrobial resistance is futile. Now, that is quite enough Dalek jokes. Thank you very much. Adam Roberts from University College London. Antibiotics are not the only weapon in the war against infection. All species have viruses that attack them. 100 years ago, a class of virus that only infects bacteria were discovered, and they're called bacteriophages, or just phages for short. And because they exist to infect bacteria, they were immediately adopted as a potential therapy for bacterial infections in people. Phages inject their genetic material into bacteria and rapidly replicate, killing their bacterial hosts. Phage therapies were used throughout the era of Soviet Russia and still are in some post-Soviet countries, including Georgia. A couple of years ago, BBC Balkans correspondent Damian McGuinness went to Tbilisi to see the treatment in action.
Sofiko has come here today because she has bronchitis. The doctor takes a tissue sample from her throat with a swab to find out what sort of phage should be used. It's the first time Sofiko has considered taking viruses to treat an infection.
I don't mind if I use antibiotics or phages. I just want to use whatever works best.
The sample from Sofiko's throat is then analysed in this lab, and within 3 days she'll find out which viruses can be used for treatment. One advantage of phages is that they only target the harmful bacteria, says Dr. Naomi Hoyle, who works here at the Eliava Institute in Tbilisi.
It's not the silver bullet that the antibiotics is, but it has its advantages. It enters the infectious site and multiplies and continues to do its work even after application.
Meanwhile, back at the clinic, patients who have received the results of their analysis have come back to pick up the phage treatment from a pharmacy counter. Boxes the size of a large packet of aspirins contain half a dozen small bottles. The solution can either be injected, sprayed directly onto the infection, or, in the case of stomach infections, swallowed. This patient tells me that he regularly uses phages to treat a recurring eye infection.
I've tried everything. I've even had operations on my eye and nothing helped. But this does help.
So that's Georgia, but the question for us is whether and when it's coming over here. I spoke to phage researcher Martha Clokey and I asked her, are we nearly there yet?
Well, we're getting there. There's much more of an awareness that we need to develop alternatives to antibiotics such as bacteriophages. So there's a lot of interest now from doctors who previously were not as interested in this approach.
And what about their use in Georgia? It's been pretty successful from the sound of things, but why are we still tinkering around the edges in this country?
Well, that's exactly what the Georgians ask. They've used them historically, so they have a long history of using them. They have doctors who are trained to use them, and they use them in specific ways very often. So, for example, if somebody presents with a respiratory condition that's chronic, they will be given phages, whereas if they have an acute condition, they'll be given antibiotics. So they use phages to prevent antibiotic resistance, and they use them in specific ways. In the West, we still don't have an appropriate regulatory pathway for phages to be used. There are no regulated phage products that we can use. In order for something to be regulated, you need to go through appropriate clinical trials. So we are getting there because there are several clinical trials going on at the moment for different conditions. So that's new since we spoke last.
I want to ask a historical question. Why hasn't phage therapy been developed more in this country and in the States? We've known about phages for 100 years. But we've really focused on antibiotics rather than phages. And why is that?
Well, I think bacteriophages were just thought to be unnecessary. Antibiotics were thought to be the silver bullet. They worked. In a way, to use an antibiotic, you have to know much less about the bacteria that you're trying to treat. With phages, they have this exquisitely specific relationship between the phage and the pathogen. So if you want to treat an E. coli infection, you need to make sure your virus will target that particular E. coli strain. And I think because it was a more complicated product to develop from this specificity point of view, and also in terms of making a standard product, it is more complicated to make up a phage mixture than it is to make a pure antibiotic. It was thought that it wasn't a necessary thing.
And in Georgia, is what you're suggesting that although they're using it and relatively effectively using phages to treat actual bacterial infections, they haven't necessarily gone through the same procedures that we would have done in terms of clinical trials and assessments?
That's right. And it's partly because they've always used them. So their argument has been, well, we've used them and we know they work. Therefore, why do we need to do these other assessments?
Which is sort of fair enough, I suppose.
I think we can learn, probably in the West, we can learn a lot from the way that the Georgians use phages, and probably we can combine that with the way in which we want to develop antimicrobials. So I think it's going to take a real collaboration between phage scientists, people who are used to drug development, and doctors at the front end who are seeing patients that they can't treat. So it's going to be these sort of collaborations so we can figure out what conditions are going to be most suitable for using phages for, how will phages be used, how will they be combined, how will we do our dosing, our formulation, our delivery. All these bits of work need to be sort of done as it were in parallel to come together.
So probably in the future most effective as part of a combined therapy for complex infections. Is there any chance that bacteria will develop resistance to phages in the same way that they have done to antibiotics?
Well, bacteria are really good at evolving resistance to anything. So if you chuck anything at a bacteria, it will become resistant to it. Now, the advantage of phages is that very often the thing that the bacteriophage actually needs to hook onto is really important for that bacteria. So, for example, if it loses a surface protein on the outside to stop the bacteria from attaching to it, then it can't colonize anymore. So there's been plenty of evidence to show that often when bacteria become resistant to phages, they become less virulent pathogens, so they can't colonize and cause infection. So at the moment, I think the first generation of bacteriophage products that will be developed will be when we have mixtures of different bacteriophages that kill in different ways. Now, if you are exposing a bacteria to phages that kill using different mechanisms, then it's much, much harder for them to become resistant. So these types of resistance studies are really important, but we can circumvent the problems that we've had using antibiotics by using them correctly and in the correct combinations to actually slow down these resistance rates.
Martha Clokey from the University of Leicester. That is all we have time for now. Antimicrobial resistance is a big deal and it's a complex story and we've only just skimmed the surface. We did ask all of our guests just how worried they are.
I'm bloody petrified, to be honest. I don't think there's the economic or political impetus to properly get behind it at the moment. There's been a lot of noise and there's a little bit more funding coming through. But I don't think it's nearly enough, and it's also not joined up.
I think it's terrifying. I think that you can definitely imagine a situation where people are coming in with bacteria that we don't currently have tools for.
By 2050, 10 million people will die from drug-resistant infections around the world, which is more people than die of cancer at the moment.
I'm not too worried for people in the rich West. I think bringing new broad-spectrum antibiotics to market for poor parts of the world where they're needed is going to be much more difficult.
And there's a link to the O'Neill report on the website. It is well worth a read. Email us at bbcinsidescience@bbc.co.uk. I'm Adam Rutherford. See you next week.